listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
Okay, today's show is brought to you by Warby Parker. Visit warbyparker.com for your next pair of eyeglasses. Okay, here's the thing. When you become more and more popular with a podcast or whatever it might be, people ask you to, you know, promote certain things on your podcast. You get paid to advertise certain products. The dilemma I have is I'm not advertising anything I don't believe in. It's just never going to happen. I've got to either use the product or believe in the product. And I recently found out I need glasses. I go to the, you know, Lens Crafter or one of these big companies. I find out, by the way, there are only really three big players in the eyeglass market. You have your choice. They keep the price artificially high. What a surprise. This is the kind of thing I talk about all the time. There's a concentration of corporate power in this country. It's becoming easier and easier, and you have fewer and fewer choices. I don't know if I'm 100% accurate on that, but I have a problem with it. Warby Parker comes along, a small company that says, you know what, man? Everybody's paying way too much for eyeglasses. We can provide a better frame. We can provide a better lens in style for $95, $100, $140, not $300, okay? On top of that, they'll let you order five frames, try them on at home for five days completely, you know, free, and you send them back for free. Choose the one you want. Oh, and by the way, if you buy the glasses from Warby Parker, they will donate a pair to someone in need. According to Warby Parker, and I'm inclined to believe them, almost a billion people out there don't have access to adequate eyewear. That means they can't see very well, which means they can't read very well. And I always say on this podcast, reading is probably the most important thing you can do. And Warby Parker is making a difference by providing eyeglasses to people that can't afford it. When you buy a pair, they will donate a pair to someone in need. That's what I call ethics. That's what I call a great company. That's why I'm proud to promote warbyparker.com on this podcast. And by the way, use the promo code BCS, which stands for Brian Callen Show. Use that promo code and they will ship you the glasses in 2 days. It's called two-day expedited shipping, all right? So that's my pitch for Warby Parker. If you need glasses, go there. They're awesome. Warbyparker.com. You can do it on the internet. Use the promo code BCS. Get yourself a pair of glasses. That's exactly what I'm doing because I need them. I can't believe it. I'm getting older. I'm outraged. I don't have eagle eyes anymore, everyone. I'm a plus one. It means I used to be perfect. Now I'm just off perfect. That's how I look at it. I still have very, very hypnotic. My eyes are very hypnotic. So once again, warbyparker.com, promo code BCS.
All right, everybody. This is the Brian Callen Show. And very quickly, before I get into this, let me tell you what my May schedule is. I just had a killer week in Edmonton, Alberta. That's Canada. And I want to thank everybody who came out in force. I had a blast, man. And by the way, it was snowing the day I left. Get it together, Alberta. Get it together. Why did you guys move that north? Who decided to go that far north? Didn't you figure maybe let's stop at the border? Or, I don't know, was Seattle that bad? But they're hardcore people, and they're great, and I had a blast, so thank you. I will be at the West Palm Beach Improv, one of my favorite places to perform, May 10th, 11th, and 12th. Then I'll be in Portland at the Helium Comedy Club, May 16th, 17th, 18th. Then I'm going to be at the DC Improv, I just found out, May 30th, 31st, 1st, and 2nd, and I'm going to be bringing some heat. That was where I went to college. I can't wait to perform down there. Amazing club. And I'm just excited about what I'm doing right now. It seems to be working. Fun to reinvent yourself when you have to say goodbye to all your old stuff and do new stuff. You never know if it's going to work. You don't know if you even have it in you. But that's one of the great things about being creative and using your brain and trying to surprise yourself and never staying comfortable. Speaking of never staying comfortable, I'm looking at my father, the man who gave birth to me, not gave birth to me, but I am of his loins. I think. Is that? I don't know. You don't seem to be that affectionate to me. Maybe this is, I mean, we do look a little bit alike. God help me. As I get older, I get glimpses of myself and I realize I'm.
What's interesting is as you get older, you will come to resemble me more and more.
Well, that's a problem. This podcast is already turning out to be a disaster. Back by popular demand, ladies and gentlemen, I got Big Mike Callen. Big Mike Callen, I wanted to, you're on Facebook because my father doesn't believe that anybody listens to this. And, you know, we're getting in the tens and tens of thousands of downloads. It's pretty crazy. And I want to thank everybody for doing that. But, you know, you've made quite an impact. I think you've been downloaded by more people than anybody else. And I've had some pretty big people on the podcast. So how can they get in touch with you if they have questions or they want to reach out?
Explain to me what downloads are. No. They should communicate if they should descend to those depths. They should communicate with me through you, I think.
Oh, okay. He doesn't want to hear from anybody.
No, that's not true. I just think it's more organized that way.
Yeah, all right. So if you want to send Big Mike any props, send them to me and I'll forward them to him. You are on Facebook, though. You are on Facebook. Are you ever on your Facebook?
I do occasionally go on my Facebook page. I did so.
And it's under Mike Callen?
Yes, and I looked at it in February.
okay, forget it then. You're too busy reading or listening to. What courses? Are you taking any courses? Well, because we're going to talk, I think. I've decided the theme is going to be just how to stay inspired and how to keep reinventing yourself and how to stay. You're 73 almost. And you seem to be as active, at least mentally and very much so physically, but as you ever have been. And I notice when I'm traveling that a lot of people just don't know where to place their energy. I notice that a lot of people are always trying to get out of the state of sobriety. They're always trying to drink and party, and that's how they have a good time. And I think there's something wrong with that. Nobody ever really talks about it, but I think it's just a product of not being inspired and not realizing that there is a lot out there to be sober for.
Well, you asked me what courses. At the moment, I'm engaged in reviewing basic math, you know, the algebra, analytic algebra. I want to get back up and redo calculus. But
why would
you
want to do that? What a fucking bore.
No. There is great joy in looking at a math problem, which 2 weeks ago you could never have known how to start and to successfully complete it. And you look in the back of the exercise book and see that you got it right. I don't know about other people. I can only speak for myself. There are few feelings that are more rewarding than that one, and there aren't many areas.
But you don't use it. It's not. It has no utility.
Oh, of course, you use it every day, whether you're doing it in a subtle, subconscious way or not, because it's all about putting various facts together and coming to a rational conclusion.
So it's an exercise in how to think. It's kind of like lifting weights for your brain.
You just said people get drunk and so forth. I think the thing that bothers me the most as a human being walking planet Earth for however many years, and for how many years in the future, I don't know, is the lack of logical power, logical process, what we call the scientific method you see in people's opinions and how they arrive at them. And there is a book written that I've recently finished, which I think is very useful. It's called How to Win Every Argument, and it's got I don't remember, but it's probably got 10 chapters. You could find it on Amazon. But it's got 10 chapters or so, maybe a few more, about the fallacies in almost every argument. And one of them I'm thinking about right now that I see the most is called selective perception. So I say to you, well, what do you think about what do you think about Muslim men? And let me pretend that you would respond, because I happen to know somebody who does this way. They're all terrorists. They're all insane. They're all crazy. And one thing and another. You're selecting from the world at large. And by the way, there's a billion Muslims. You're selecting some crackpots who are misguided enough to have done some really bad things, but it has no connection with Islam at large. There's an increasing number of people susceptible to that bad reasoning in this country who are coming up with those kinds of thoughts. And the one I'm thinking about right now is a graduate of Harvard. So it's not a question of level of education.
Yeah, it's like looking at, you know, wrinkles and saying wrinkles cause senility. When in fact it's something else in the brain. You're looking at something and you're attributing a something that goes with most people who have that and blaming, I guess, the wrong thing for the disease, as it were.
Yeah, and by the way, mathematics is the queen of the sciences, and everyone has math anxiety. But the way it's being taught today, and we have talked on this podcast before about the great blessing called the Teaching Company, and they have all of these courses on DVD,
and by the way, you can get them, guys, on. You can digitally download them. I just finished listening to The Great Turning Points in Modern History, most of which I thought I knew, and because I read history, and I didn't. And now I'm listening to the Turning Points, The Great Turning Points of American History. Again, I thought it was going to be just a refresher course. There's a lot of stuff I don't know in there. But it's so important for perspective. And you know how the I'm sorry to interrupt you, but very quickly, guys. One of the things, the professor defined history, and I loved it, as the study of conflict and the study of decisions. History is not inevitable events. Events are caused by individuals who make choices, and it can have a huge impact on the next 50 years. So it's in that sense, you gain that kind of perspective when you listen to those courses for you guys out there. It's about reading. It's about listening to books on Audible when you don't have time to read in your car instead of music. And you can get an amazing education through all different kinds of resources, one of which being the Teaching Company. Keep going. I'm sorry.
You raise a very good point. We've talked about it before in this forum. And I'm going to recommend a book by David Fromkin called Europe's Last Summer. And it is about the origins of World War I. And we mentioned a short while ago in a conversation, if you had a convention of historians, worldwide historians, met in a great convention center, and they were asked to fill out a survey, and one of the questions would be, what is the most important year of the last 100? Hands down, the answer would be 1914.
Which was the start of World War I, everybody.
And you ask your friends. It did very large things to the lives we are leading today, and very small things we don't even think about. I mentioned to you that out of World War I came daylight savings time, without spending time on why. But there were just endless. It was the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It brought Germany to its knees,
and that led
to World War II and led to the Iron Curtain, led to the rise of communism. So I mean, it can go on and on forever as to what that year brought about. Fromkin's thesis, by the way, in just one sentence, which can't do it justice. This is not a complicated book, by the way. He makes a point at the beginning. Again, let's go back to a class at a major university of PhD history candidates, and you would say, write down, not taking more than one page, the causes of World War I. And everybody would have a different thesis. This is very common. But Fromkin's contribution here is to make the point that World War I was really two wars. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was declining, Emperor Franz Joseph and so forth, was having a lot of problems with the Balkans, particularly Serbia. And, of course, the guy that assassinated the Archduke was a Croatian, but had connections to the Serbian Black Hand, the secret society there. And we don't know today whether they were active in their support. They were certainly sympathetic. But this guy and a couple of other guys came along, and just anecdotally here, they set off a bomb, and it misfired, didn't work. It went off, but wrong after the Archduke was past his car. And in fact, that bomb did kill a person.
So, I mean, it's funny how terrorism has been around for a very long time.
Well, I want to comment on that in a minute, but yeah. Let me just complete the story. And then the Archduke went on to his meeting, and then he came out and continued on his program. It's the first time he had been in Sarajevo, and he had a dinner that evening at a big gala dinner with all of the royalty and so forth, his last night of life. And the next day in his car, an open car, he and his wife, the driver took a wrong turn. And the assassin who had set off the bomb was in, believe it or not, a coffee shop where the car made a wrong turn. The car had to stop. The car had to stop, and it had to back out, having recognized it made the wrong turn. And this guy just walked out of the coffee shop and went up and killed them both.
Took a wrong turn.
Took a wrong turn.
You could almost say the driver made the wrong turn, which was, in some ways, that wrong turn started World War One. I mean, it's a little far. That's a big leap. But in a way, you could make a movie about it, because in a way, that is true.
If you buy the premise that the assassination of the Archduke caused World War One, which has been, I think, discredited, but that would be a good story. But
that's almost
fictional.
That's almost a math problem. I mean, that's almost sort of the idea of right. I mean, you know,
right. But the point that Fromkin makes is that World War One would have happened anyway.
Sure,
I don't know. It would have started in August. By the way, the Archduke was assassinated June 25th. So the drama that unfolded after that within Europe, and also remember that the Kaiser in Germany, Wilhelm, was a cousin of Nicholas II in Russia. All the royalty was related, and the Kaiser knew Nicholas as a kid. And it was like, you know, not like you and me as father and son, but certainly like me and my nephew.
And they went to war against each other.
They tried very hard to avoid it. But here is the key thing. It was two wars. So it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire trying to deal with, already in decline, by the way, trying to deal with its upstart revolutionary-type Balkan constituents. And at the same time, it was the Kaiser in Germany being just as concerned as Hitler was 30 years later that the Russians were someday going to invade Germany, and you'd better get them now while they're still weak before they rearm.
Right, amazing.
So it was really two wars, with the Kaiser having had no choice when he signed some treaties to support the Austro-Hungarians.
In that sense, though, that it sounds to me, as I learn more about history, that a lot of that is so inevitable. A lot of conflict was never up to one man. It was just a confluence of events. It became a snowball that nobody could stop, almost, you know?
Conflict is as much a part of the life that we all lead as anything I can think of. I won't say a part as it is of food. You have conflict every day when you get up in the morning with other human beings, because there are finite resources. I'm not one that promotes the idea of wars. I mean, we've got to find a way to avoid that. But you're saying you're going to avoid wars, you're going to avoid violence, is not the same as to say you're going to avoid conflict, because there is no earthly way you should waste your time trying to avoid conflict. We have conflict in almost everything we do.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. I think that one of the things that you realize is that you're always in conflict with yourself, just getting up and doing the right thing every morning. And once you get yourself used to the fact that resistance is a part of life, exercise, when you don't want to exercise, is like getting into a cold bath and you have to wait till your body acclimates. If you get used to the fact that everything is difficult, you want to get muscular, you want to get in shape, but look at it in years. If you want to get rich, invest over years. You're not getting rich in 2 months. That's the idea. But go back to how to win every argument. I like what you were talking about, where arguments are a matter of perception. Explain a little bit more about what you were talking about.
I've talked before about the 4-step process to understanding how people conduct themselves. There is behavior. We can all see how people behave. If you and I were to watch a third party, we'd probably come pretty close to agreeing how that person behaves. He goes and kicks the car. He drives fast. He makes a left turn. That's easy. And then right behind that are the feelings the person had, which we could probably get fairly close to describing, too. He had feelings of great anger and turmoil. So he struck out and hit somebody, or he drove like a maniac and not even thinking about the dangers. He was feeling some very strong emotions. We can even agree on that. Right behind that, it gets much more difficult, because then the next thing behind that is perceptions. And you and I can look at the same thing and have very different perceptions of what we're looking at.
There's that old saying, there are three people in an argument. There's three people. There are three sides to every argument. Your side, my side, and the truth. And nobody's wrong, or nobody's lying, you know.
Well, it may be that nobody is lying, but in fact, one of the great underlying principles of all philosophies is that there is a truth.
Yes.
It just takes a hard, long slog to get to it.
Right.
But then you go back to the fourth thing, which
that's
even
an important point, by the way. That's a very important point. We live in a world of cynicism and relativism, and what you just said is a very important thing to highlight. There is a truth. There is a truth. It takes a lot of work to get to it, and you're right. I mean, that's why you have to earn an opinion, earn your principles, and earn your way of life in a way, right?
You have to work very hard at
wisdom.
It. And it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop when you get older. But let me get back before we complete this. So we've got behavior, we agree. Feelings that drove that behavior, I think we can all come down to the same general conclusion. Perceptions, we start to divide significantly.
You don't have to talk that
close. And then you go back down, you go back to assumptions, the underlying assumptions that every one of us carries around with us every day, right? And we don't think about those because those have grown up with us from childhood. The most common assumption is religion, religious views. Mm. So there are a billion people in this world who are Muslim. There are about a billion, two, I think, that
Catholic.
Are Christian.
Yeah.
And the assumptions that they all carry with them from birth is, number one, there is a God, that the God is responsible for much of what is happening in the world. In Islamic cultures, God giveth and God taketh away. So it's much more fatalistic than I think Christianity is. But then again, it's much younger than Christianity. It's Christianity is 1,400 years older than Islam.
Actually, I think it's 700 years older than Islam.
Well, Islam started in about 632 is probably the date that Islam started. Sorry, it's 650 years older.
Yeah.
Sorry, I misspoke. Right. There is a thesis around that when Islam is another 600 years old, it'll be a very different religion. I have no expertise. I would think it would evolve, but we'll see. But what I'm saying is, when you're dealing with an Islamic culture, you're dealing with one where Allahu Akbar, and they feel very strongly about
that. Yeah.
God is great. And that assumption is very embedded in their soul and is very different, taking the other extreme, than an atheist would be.
But wouldn't you say, by the way, that we have to also distinguish between very different Muslims? I mean, Indonesian Muslims are typically way more open to interpreting the Quran as opposed to Saudi Muslims, who are more a part of the Wahhabi sect, in comparison to, say, Egyptian Muslims, who the vast majority are rather cosmopolitan, Iraqi Muslims, Sunni Muslims versus Shia Muslims. I mean, the Quran is a very, very, you can interpret it a great many ways.
The first major division in the world of Islam is Sunni versus Shia.
That's right.
When as opposed
Muhammad
to different geographies,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the Iranians are all Shia, the Saudis are all Sunni, although they both have communities of the other among them.
Yes.
And that is the biggest problem that they have, if you want to look at the future, and we're talking about conflict.
Well, are you optimistic about the fact that technology and commerce is going to is going to sort of blur the lines between Shia, Alawite, Sunni, etc. in the Arab world, or no? You've lived there. You know, guys, you lived in the Arab world for how many years?
10 years.
Yeah.
The strange perception here on my part. When I went and lived in Saudi Arabia the first time, which was in 1978, and I lived there with you, by the way,
yep,
about 4 years, 3 years, three and a half, in Riyadh, mm-hmm, a place that the first Westerner came to in 1947 for the first time. We didn't have satellite TV. We had, if you wanted to call Jeddah, which is 350 miles away within inside of Saudi Arabia, you had to make the reservation on the phone 24 hours ahead of time. Then I went back there in 1993 to Jeddah this time, which is the commercial port, and stayed for 3 years. And as I think I've said on this podcast before, my wife and I very much enjoyed both visits, and I don't know how much you remember. You must remember.
Yeah,
some.
I was 14 when I left, so I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
It,
yeah. And so I think you enjoyed living there too. Yeah, but we weren't living the life that most people read about in Saudi Arabia. It was there. We observed it, but we didn't live it. But when we got back in 1993, suddenly everybody had a dish on their roof. You could get any TV station you wanted. You pick up the telephone and direct dial anywhere, including the United States. That was an enormous revolution. At the same time that in 1978, you saw people beginning to really change, westernize, do things they normally wouldn't have done. Women started to dress differently. Came back in 1993, all of that social behavior had changed to the more conservative side.
That may have very well been a reaction to something that seemed overwhelming, something that seemed that would very well spin out of control. You know, the information age is a very hard thing for people to put into context. I mean, you're talking about technology in the next 20 years that we may be able to reverse engineer the human brain, download information into your brain, download your memories. This is something that people are talking about, you know, being a reality in 20, 30 years or less. That's very difficult to put into context, because what it means is, in many ways, the destruction of everything that we know in a lot of ways. So much of progress is really destruction of what used to be. And human beings, you know, have a very hard time with that. And one of the things that, you know, people think about immigration, for example, as, people, the shit hits the fan and they just get on a boat and leave. No. In fact, most people try to ride it out, even no matter how bad it is, even when their lives are in danger, they stay where they grew up. And it's much more terrifying to go somewhere else. So to change for human beings is very overwhelming. And we are living in a time of exponential change. It's no longer change over 100 years. I think things are changing so rapidly. We're going to push so far beyond our own biology. But more than that, I think we are getting into the realm of the brain, where you're going to be able to read people's thoughts or map people's thoughts, etc. What do you do with that? You know, this is new frontier that we don't have context for in a lot of ways.
All of that you said is correct, but it's not new. Hmm. I think that my great-grandparents at the turn of the last century, 1900, if you think about the lives that they led, and then do a fast forward to where we are today, there was an enormous revolutionary change. I don't know that people could have negotiated through today's world if they suddenly came back.
Right.
At the same time, what impresses me is the stability of human beings. Not all good things, a lot of them bad things. About how people behave essentially pretty much the way they must have back in those days. Let's take an example of what I'm trying to get at here. See, I happen to think that the American society we live in has a very deeply embedded violent culture and aspect to it. And this goes back to gun control. None of us want to see some of the horrible things that have happened. I'm still sick to my stomach about Newtown. But the idea of eliminating guns or doing anything of that kind in this country is just an absolute non-starter, because the country grew up with guns in every pocket. You couldn't survive without guns. It's a deeply felt...
It's part of our mythology.
I live in Utah now.
It's part of our mythology.
My life in Utah is about 2 years old now. And all you have to do is mention any kind of restriction on guns, and people will shoot you.
Well, they're so nuts about it. I own guns. My feeling is, I just think that when you can buy guns at a gun show or online without a background check, you need a background check to adopt a dog or rent an apartment. All I'm asking is, isn't there some kind of a mechanism where crazies can't go in and buy 17 guns? Or you walk into a gun show, and if you got a big enough pocketbook, you can buy everything and then sell it out of the back of your car somewhere else. I just think that since 60% or whatever it is of federally licensed gun dealers have, you know, background checks, 76,000 applications are turned down last year, I believe, because people lied on their background checks. It's a big number. I do think that there's a mechanism at least to put a dent into, you know, or figuring out a way for crazies not to get guns. And I don't accept the fact that, well, some people are just nuts. No, I believe every problem is solvable, and there is common sense legislation. This is coming from a libertarian who owns guns, not some, you know, city liberal who's like, I don't like guns. I get it. But I just think that the NRA is losing the argument. I don't want to live in a society where, you know, a crazy guy goes in and kills a bunch of kids, and nobody does. But
let me take you back to a conversation I had a month ago with a European friend of mine. The conversation had nothing to do with guns. It had to do with immigration, and that's a subject we can talk about later. He said, you guys in this country, the United States, if you're going to make a law, you ought to enforce your law. And my point to him was, we don't do that in the United States. We have loads of laws we don't enforce. We'll talk later about why that is. But it's observably a very clear fact. Let's use a pedestrian, no pun intended, example. They got a law against jaywalking in Manhattan. They got a law against crossing against the light.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear of anybody not jaywalking
in
Manhattan?
There are sodomy laws in the South still.
And yeah, fornication laws, too.
Yeah, outrageous.
The point, though, is, but to see, those are laws that have long outlived any usefulness. Yeah. They can only be used in an arbitrary manner to get somebody for another reason.
We're all fans of
sodomy. But jaywalking, if you try to jaywalk in most European cities, there are going to be whistles blown and tickets issued, and they're going to look at you like you're crazy.
Yeah.
That's not the United States.
It's not the American character.
The United States' history was, there was very little regulation. People's behavior was up to them or up to their little town they formed.
Which is to our credit.
It's important. So on immigration, we have 11 million illegals. What country in the world can have 11 million illegals? One might add in parentheses, what country in the world would 11 million illegals want to get into? And there aren't that many. There might be one or two. So we've got this border with Mexico. We don't enforce that law. So I think one must distinguish between a law we passed and we battle on television and we battle in our Congress to get a law passed, and the outcome, the result of it.
Yeah.
There are so many laws we've passed where there's drugs.
Yeah, drugs is a joke.
It's a joke. So if you say guns,
we do enforce drugs. We ruin a lot of people's lives and put them in jail. I mean,
right.
who are selling weed.
Yep, about 2 million. That hadn't made any dent whatsoever. So the point is,
I was just in Edmonton. All due respect, I love you guys, but there's a lot of drugs that you can get. You can tap somebody on the shoulder and get any kind of drug you want right then and there. So it's done nothing, you know. And granted, that's another country, but it's all the same.
It's one of those laws that well-intentioned people made beautiful speeches about. Do you want to have our citizens inject poison into their veins? And everybody shouted and clapped and said no. And we did not for lack of effort. We could not keep drugs out of the hands of people who want them. It would be twice or three times the futility to try to do that with guns. The people want guns. Now you can say, what about a background check? Nobody I know has real faith that a background check is going to do anything. All of us should hate passionately Adam Lanza, this nut in Utah, in Newtown. May he burn on the lowest ring of hell, in Dante's hell. But, and I, you know, it could have been my little grandson. I don't even want to think about it. I want to go and throw up. I haven't heard one idea, either I came up with in my own head or I've heard debated, that would have done anything about Newtown.
The
only one that nobody wants to debate, because you're supposed to be some kind of a Neanderthal man, is this idea of more guns, where good people can stop bad people.
That's also a bad idea. I agree that the only thing that stops a guy like that is a bullet between the eyes. And there should have been some kind of, you know, you would always want some kind of a rapid reaction force. It's kind of the way in Rwanda, the guy said, as the UN was haggling over, and I think with the United States, over the rental fees, the UN was haggling over the rental fees for armored cars for 6 weeks. And in that period, 300,000 Rwandans lost their lives. The way you handle a situation like Rwanda is you get a groups of commandos in there with armored cars. You get RPGs and missile shoulder you know, to air surface missiles, whatever they are, whatever it is. Just get some firepower. When you see a truck full of guys with machetes coming into a fucking a town to kill a bunch of kids, you kill those guys. You kill them. And you kill as many of those truckloads. And now, then you send, and what happens is you go, anybody, if we see a group of men in a truck, you're all going to die. If our helicopter gunships or we see you, you're going to die. What happens is everybody goes, I'm not going to get in a truck with you, dude. We might get shot. And that's how you stop violence real quick.
Or
that's,
I might get my reward of virgins when I go to, you know,
whatever.
You
I mean, I'm just
Islamic.
I'm talking about
death.
How to
death
stop
is no
some,
deterrent to an. To,
no,
to
but some violence.
By the way, we're doing that now with drones, right?
Yeah, and by the way, I have a problem with it. I mean, to
well,
an
you
extent,
just said we should do that.
No, I was talking about a specific case of senseless violence like Rwanda. That's a more complicated issue. I think in some ways the question has to be raised. We've gotten very good at killing. What has it done for us? And there are two sides to that argument.
There's two sides to every argument. You don't know what it's done for us.
That's right. I don't. That's why I stay quiet on it.
Let me suggest a book written by a man named Philip Mudd, and it's called Takedown. Not a long book again. Maybe 200 pages. Philip Mudd joined the CIA in about 1993, this is memory now, was there after 9/11, and then went over to the FBI in about 2006, and then spent another 5 years there. He's now at a university, and he tells the whole story about the effort post 9/11 to track down bad guys, to find out who people are. It was an immensely complex project, using an incredible input of resources. But where they finally got was to the point where they practically knew everybody who had been, quote-unquote, radicalized. And they had a very good fix, including, and I know people in the CIA who have, this is not to be attributed, and I'm not putting this out into the public to say, boy, I know something, but I think we all know it's in general well known. For example, the bad guys, for lack of a better term, took over a hotel in Afghanistan, and they were using it as their command post, And wouldn't you know, our CIA, that never gets enough credit, by the way, intercepted all of their communications and was able to anticipate and know ahead of time when they were going to put a bomb in a marketplace. And they would take out the guys on their way to do it, wow, whether it was with drone or otherwise, for a story to be written a lot later than this. So where I came out of that, which I did not believe before I read the book by Mudd, is that through a hell of a lot of hard work, tremendous amounts of intelligence, and if you saw Zero Dark Thirty, the beginning of that was controversial, but you saw the amount of work and the surveillance of that compound
and in
Ahmedabad.
And
they were watching it. And for example, I found it interesting because I happen to know it's absolutely true. There are four females, but we only see three males at any time showing themselves. There must be another male. Who would that other male be? And then they went through that whole process. Get the helicopters warmed up, guys. I think this is it. But it took months to do that. One of the things that movie stressed is, hey, the girl, I know he is in there. But the president had to be convinced.
Yeah.
And the president doesn't get convinced just willy-nilly, like there's a bunch of guys in a truck with guns. He had the absolutely, and then it turned out that it was correct. But what that is in a less publicized way done is it's happened endless numbers of time. The most dangerous job in the world for the last 12 years has been number three in Al-Qaeda. Because they've all been killed.
Yeah.
They've all been wiped out. And the guys below them get wiped out. You don't want to accept that audition to be a messenger for Al-Qaeda.
No, you don't.
They'll find out right away, and you're going to be vaporized.
Yeah, that's right.
So they have really... Some people think, oh, they didn't want to attack us again. Now, I want to add a complicating factor here. Let's understand that the reason that Osama bin Laden took the action he did and used his $300 million inheritance from the bin Ladens, the reason that he did all of those radical things, went to Sudan and in Afghanistan, is because we, the West, not just the United States, primarily the United States, was occupying, from his point of view, the homeland of the two holy mosques, i.e. Saudi Arabia, and supporting a corrupt anti-Islamic regime.
Yes.
Supporting and aligning themselves with the great Satan. We left Saudi Arabia.
Great Satan being the United States.
Yeah. We left Saudi Arabia after the Iraqi War, number two, Desert Storm, and that really removed a lot of the motives for Osama's belligerence and passions. Not all of them. There are a lot of people that would love to be able to have some giant, spectacular strike, Madison Square Garden kind of thing. But the essential point I'm making is that the FBI domestically, the CIA internationally, in conjunction with a lot of other intelligence services, particularly the British, have been very successful in tracking these guys down.
I just read a book called The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright that won a Pulitzer Prize for this. And I reckon he did 5 years of exhaustive study on 9/11, the road to Al-Qaeda and the road to 9/11, and even the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. It's a fascinating book that all the people that are conspiracy theorists should actually read some real like investigative journalism. Because it's pretty fascinating, and you're right. The CIA and the FBI did an amazing job. The question becomes: what I think the value was that I think anybody in the future who thinks there's any profit in terrorist activity has got to know, if they have any kind of a rational brain, they've got to know that there is whatever objective they're trying to achieve is not going to be achieved. If anything, it's just going to be not only suicide, but probably just their entire world will just be wiped out. So I think in that sense, that example was probably rings. I think North Korea's got to know that.
They have a tough time recruiting. I mean, I think that's true. They have a limited pool from which to recruit.
Well,
they don't exactly
the
say, we've got a role for a suicide bomber and have a bunch of people come and audition.
What's...
But remember this. We said a little while ago, if profit in your life, going back to assumptions, if profit is in the afterlife, and if doing something against the great Satan and all the forces of evil in this world are going to earn you a much higher place in the afterlife, you've got a significant
Well, one of the things I noticed when I went to Afghanistan was that a lot of those soldiers are building hospitals and orphanages, and I don't think it's lost on the U.S. government, and there's a lot to criticize about the effort. But I don't think it's lost on anyone that there's a hard hand and there's a soft hand. If you're going to destroy, you got to build. And one of the criticisms about Iraq, but there's also another side, because I know a guy who was a real intelligence guy. And in fact, Tom Bigley, who I have on the podcast, Delta Force guy. I mean, there are huge swaths of northern Iraq, Kurdistan and stuff that are doing very, very well economically. In comparison to what they were doing. Baghdad has got problems. There's no question that we destroyed the infrastructure of that country, that their current president, who's a Shia, Alawaki, I think his name is becoming in some way, some would say, a mini Saddam. He's got his own police force that reports just to him. So the Sunnis and the Shias are still fighting over resources. So I'm not suggesting that if you're Iraqi, your life is better, especially if you live in the Sunni triangle. But there is something to be said for the fact that there are parts of Iraq that are doing better than they were, and it's not all bleak and all dreck. It's unfair to the effort made there and to the lives lost on both sides to say so. I'm an optimist. I guess what I'm saying is I don't think all those lives that were lost and all those men and women who were wounded, I don't believe that the effort was in vain. I can't believe that because I don't want to anyway. And there's a lot you could, you know, I'm sure a lot of people could argue with me and change my mind maybe. But I just don't want to believe that. And I think at the end of the day, I hope in 10 years, Iraq is going to be a better place. I would imagine they're pointed in that direction more than they were before when they were living under someone like a Saddam Hussein. Maybe I'm naive, but I hope not. I don't know, you know. Let me ask you this. Let's change the subject a little bit. I've been thinking about this. As I realize, you know, there are two kinds of learning. One is academic, and the other is there are only some things you can know by doing them. You can only really learn how to fight by fighting, playing an instrument by playing, doing stand-up comedy by doing stand-up comedy in front of people, etc. And then there's another kind of wisdom, which is immersing yourself in the best that's been thought and said, and gaining perspective in the same stuff we've been talking about. But I was just listening recently to the symposium, Plato's Dialogues. I was listening to English actors act it out, which, by the way, everybody, I always talk about the dialogues. If you want to learn about Socrates, and everybody should, because it starts and ends with him in some ways, you listen to the dialogues. You can get them on audible.com. Listen to them, because that's how they were meant to be listened to. They're theatrical. They're arguments. Socrates changes people's minds, and in so doing, he'll change your mind with the questions he asks about the big questions in life. What is love? How do you define virtue? How do you define character? These things that affect us. And I know you're a fan of the Greeks, but let me ask
justice.
You, justice. What is justice? Which they define as everything in its place, in its rightful place. I'm paraphrasing. But talk a little bit about, you know, you're 73. Talk a little bit about, I believe, and let me make a statement and see if you can comment on it. We are living in a time of technology. Things are easier. Things are abundant. You can get access to food and health care and all these things. You don't have to suffer from plagues. And even war isn't as big a threat as it used to be. And brutality, I would agree, it used to be everybody was, two-thirds of the world was enslaved in one way or another. And that no longer exists. But the responsibility of being a complete human being, an ethical, moral human being, knowing yourself and all the things that matter, the important things in life, are as relevant today as they were 3,500 years ago. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Aristotle said that there are several levels of life. In his day, of course, there was a slave, and that was considered a part of the natural order. But the highest order of life was a life of contemplation, which would be very difficult.
Define that.
A life of contemplation is doing exactly what you've just been talking about, which is to have no particular goal except every day to gain a better appreciation of the world you're living in and what happens outside of that world. And examining whatever points you're discussing or seeking, the seeking of truth, we said earlier, truth is there. It just is very, very difficult to get to. And a lot of lazy people say, well, it's hard to know what truth is. This person's truth is another person's poison. Is just not true, and it's relativism, which itself is a poison, because relativism is just intellectual laziness.
Now, when, relativism defined as whatever's right for you is right for you, what's right for me is right for me.
Precisely. Now, you may never get to truth, but you should die trying to get there. You should be on your way to it every day.
But draw the
Aristotle said every day is another step down a path you can only hope is a better, closer to the pursuit. You're always in pursuit of truth, and every day you're supposed to be getting closer to it.
But some people would say that their orthodoxy is truth, right? So some people would say, well, if you want the truth, look no further than the Bible, the Quran, the Old Testament, the Bhagavad Gita,
people of the book.
Okay, people of the book. And you always draw a distinction between people of faith and people of reason. And you're a fan of reason, of
I'm a fan of reason.
Logic.
I don't want to say negative things. There's two roads. The world divided about 2,000 years ago. There was a path to Athens and the path to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is, if you stand up on Mount Olive and look out over the city, you're looking at the bedrock of the three major religions in the world. Those are all people of the book. That's based on what our parents told us. And as a conservative, and by the way, Russell Kirk's book, The Mind of the Conservative, is very worth the effort, because, and I can't paraphrase something that Russell Kirk wrote, but not all that different from people of the book, because what he says is, do not willy-nilly or without very serious thought dismiss what centuries before us arrived at as a way of life. So you may say, I think those idiots before us who would not do something we today consider a routine, and I because I don't want to get into serious controversy, I won't come up with anything right now, but it's in all different walks of life. Russell Kirk says, as did Edmund Burke, the father of conservatism, be very careful about throwing out something which has been with this world for centuries.
Which includes faith. Faith and religion can serve. I always say, right, faith and religion can serve a purpose in a number of ways. For example, as inspiration. You tell a mother who lost her child that there is no God. Go ahead.
Right.
You know, I have a problem with those radical atheists like Hitchens and stuff, those guys, because they assume that religion is the way they are defining it. They are looking at religion with a capital T.
But read Christopher Hitchens. Let me tell you a short story.
He's great.
Young lady of 19 or something has already got two children. Give me a haircut in Park City, outside of Park City. And she lives, I believe, in Salt Lake. So she's Mormon, comes from a Mormon family. And she insists we got to talk. Usually I don't, when I'm having my hair cut, I'd rather be reading something. But, so let's talk. How often do I get to talk to a 19-year-old? And I said, Hitchens came up. I said, I wonder if you should read this book. And she said, well, yeah, I'd like to. She seemed to be intelligent. I said, tell you what, I'm going to send it to you. So when I got home, I got on Amazon.com, and I had it sent to her workplace. It was at a luxury hotel connected with a ski resort.
Was it God is Not Great? I think he wrote that. Or...
There was that one, or it was... Yes. No, it was God is Not Great.
Oh, Jesus.
So for some reason beyond me, but probably connected to all of this, the administration where she got the package opened the package.
Oh, boy.
And there was the book. And she was telling me when I got my next haircut how much flack she got for ever having a book like that on those premises. That is as dangerous or more dangerous, just as dangerous, let's put it that way, as the fanatics who think they have an absolute lock on truth.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. I agree with you. I agree with you. I think transparency, I want to know it all. I just don't assume to, I'm not a religious person, but I always feel uncomfortable with blind criticism of people's religion, because your religion is a way of life. And if religion is taken as symbolism, as much of Christianity as it can be, a very positive force in people's life, I think that you'd have a hard time arguing with the fact that a great deal of Christianity's tenets, for example, are the scaffolding in some ways that built this country, or at least were those words motivated a great number of people to do good works.
Yeah, if you look at the Ten Commandments purported to have been brought down from Mount Sinai by Moses, if you look at what those Ten Commandments are, and by the way, I had an interesting discussion not long ago in asking people if they knew if they could go through 1 through 10. And I guess it was all my grounding in the seminar.
Let's see if I can do it. You can do it.
But maybe not now. Try it later. Yeah, I can do it. But if you didn't have religion and you didn't have Moses, how many of the rules we live by would have been incorporated into the Ten Commandments? Do you think maybe we would have had thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal? I think we probably would have.
I do too.
Now, if we didn't have the first and the second, bearing false witness and, you know, false gods and all that, I suppose we might have given those a pass. They might not be a part of the lives we lead. But if you look at every other one, adultery, coveting thy neighbor's goods, what's religion about that?
Well, what's interesting about the Ten Commandments, you bring that up, is one of the unique things to the American experience is that the first five commandments are matters of personal choice in this country. That's where the separation of church and state comes in. Now I'm drawing a blank, but the commandments that are enforced are thou shalt not commit murder, thou shalt not steal, covet thy neighbor's goods. Thou shalt not commit adultery is enforceable by law if you're married. But honor thy mother and father. No. Don't worship false gods. No. Take one god as your god. You know, I think it'd be a monotheist. These are matters of personal choice, and that was a debate in this country in the 1600s.
If you don't honor your father and mother, and that's the only part I disagree with you on. If you don't honor your father and mother, if we're going back to when these cultures were producing these kinds of laws, your father or mother would literally die.
I don't disagree. What I'm trying to say is that that's not enforced by law, and it's an interesting difference. Well, that is where the separation of church and state in this country comes in. If you think about it, the first five commandments, I'm going to look them up on my phone now, are not enforceable by law. That's what's interesting about
it. And you can't force people. Here's an interesting one. Do not take the name of thy God in vain.
Yes.
In other words, don't swear. Don't say goddamn.
Yeah.
All right. I have a real problem today with the looseness of language. And I would defend that. I don't use the ubiquitous F word. Or I try to avoid as much as I can. I don't say goddamn because I was taught at a very early age.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to claim that somebody else should.
I've heard you say it. When I clogged the toilet, I remember I was 13. I heard you go, Brian, God damn it. Yeah. You've been clogging the toilet since you were 6 years old.
Yeah. But that, now you forget that's when I was shoving your head down into it.
Yeah.
But I.
Right. No. Right.
No. My point is there are certain conventions that makes sense, even though you're free to ignore them. And language is one of them. And the reason I'm saying that is I happen to believe, and maybe those listening think I'm a kook, to use the F word in front of women is disrespectful.
Well, you came up as a Marine, as an old-fashioned
even when
guy.
I was a Marine, and every other word was that.
Yeah.
I would never use it in front of
I like that. That's called being a gentleman. I think chivalry, being a
the
gentleman,
idea
and
of
manners.
The idea of a code of gentlemanliness.
Well, manners.
And manners.
Because it's discipline.
And courtesy
yeah.
have been thrown out the window by so many of the young people I meet today.
One of the things I find so refreshing about Canada is that protocol and manners are a big deal. I mean, the first thing Canadians grow up saying is sorry. And I it is very refreshing to be in a group like that. I mean, they're tough people. You go up to like Manitoba or Saskatchewan or Alberta, it's hard to live out there. Those people are rough. Those guys are out there, but they're polite.
You know what impresses me in British society, which is much criticized, class system and so forth? If you are a gentleman with a capital G in British society, one must maintain one's standards. Another way of putting it is there are certain things that are not done.
That's right.
And I'm talking about when they were prisoners of war.
That's right.
They would die rather than violate those
standards.
That's
exactly right.
There's a lot to be said for that.
That's one of the most amazing things about the British character. That's right. There are countless examples of maintaining your poise even in the most dire circumstances, which includes being a prisoner of war, includes being on the top of the mountain and freezing to death. I'm always impressed with that. Here are the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord thy God, not enforced by law. Thou shalt have no other gods, no graven images or likenesses. In other words, don't practice idolatry. Doesn't exist. That's why Madonna and Lady Gaga, etc., make so much money. Do not take the Lord's name in vain. Again, we don't enforce that by law, nor should we. Remember the Sabbath day, which I didn't know. That's the one I wouldn't have gotten. We don't enforce that by law. Honor thy mother and father. We don't enforce that by law. And those are the first five commandments. And that's very interesting that we don't. And that was an argument. That was a debate in this country back in the 1600s. I think, in fact, it was in the 1700s. Then there's thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Don't lie. Keep your promises. And thou shalt not covet. Now, I don't know about thou shalt not covet. Is that enforceable by law? How would you...
There's actually two commandments. There's thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods.
Okay.
And there's been long arguments, even in front of the Supreme Court, about what covet means. What it really means is thou shalt not envy to the point of trying to acquire.
Oh, okay.
So you don't... And again, it goes back to certain rules of behavior as a human being in a civilized society. You don't look at your neighbor's wife, your friend's wife, and say, boy, I'd like to have a relationship with her. You don't look at your neighbor's car and say, I'm going to find some way to get that car away from him.
Right.
These are not thoughts that ever produce positive outcomes. Mm. And that's really what it was about.
Explain to us the difference between immoral and unethical. I mean, I know the difference, but you hear the words thrown around a lot.
Well, first of all, you have to define morality, which is a code of conduct in a society which enables the maximum number of people to lead a life that is productive and can be led to its...
Well, that's ethics, isn't it?
I mean, no, that's a moral code. I mean, for example, it is immoral to kill somebody else. It's not unethical to kill somebody else. Unethical has to do with the goods and services that you can cheat somebody out of. If you cheat somebody in business, that's unethical.
There was a constitutional scholar who said that you can that this country is built on a couple of things, a couple of sort of principles or rules that even a preschooler could understand. Don't take what doesn't belong to you. Keep your promises. And if you violate those two, do something about it. Make amends.
Look, the whole idea behind religion going back deep into history. And remember, Judaism was the origin of all of it. And then came Christianity and Islam. And they all have central tenets. If you read the Quran and then you read the New Testament, and then you read the Old Testament, you find an awful lot of common ground. So what it all comes down to is we should never permit one human being to gain such ascendancy, such power over his fellow human beings that he is the law himself.
That's amazing. I never thought of it that way, because that's certainly the tenet of political philosophy. Who governs?
It's what Stalin did.
Yeah, who governs the governor? I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Stalin, with impunity and merely by telling people what to do, murdered tens of millions of people because Stalin said they should do it. And he murdered almost all of his compatriots in the Politburo because he said he wanted it done.
Very interesting way of defining religion. I've never thought of it that way, but that's exactly the value of religion, I guess. The central tenet is the notion that nobody should have more power over another man. God is the ultimate judge.
Right. And if you don't want to believe in God, for God's sake, don't substitute God with some tyrant like Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, or Saddam Hussein.
Or Vladimir Lenin.
Or
Adolf Hitler.
You see what happens with history. You see what happens when you worship false gods. I went to YouTube, and I suggest everybody do so, and I watched some of Hitler's speeches. I got to tell you, as an actor, that guy was one of the greatest performers. You know, you talk about theatrical, and you can see without the benefit of historical perspective how people could be moved by a guy like that, regardless of his poisonous ideology, which in many ways he kept secret strategically for long enough to carry it out. But that's why you got to be very careful of sharp profiles of people who are very charismatic, of what they call a demagogue. So whenever you're a guy, and a lot of young people listen to this, whenever you're around a guy who seems to have all the answers, man, and it's real, and it's people of my age, I walk around thinking I have the answers. Don't listen to anybody too carefully. Read all points of view. You got to learn how to make your own choices, because anything else is dangerous.
I don't disagree with that statement, but you got to make decisions too.
Yeah,
and I know a lot of people that say it's too complicated, and you know it's a cliche, but don't ever lose sight of the fact that no decision is a very important decision.
Well, how do you, for young people, how do you, with all the information out there, for God's sake, how do you make the right choice? I mean, you got
good,
the
internet. Good book called by a fellow who, by the way, is above all a statistician. And his name's escaped me, but it's called The Signal Versus the Noise. I'll think of it. Nate Silver.
You've talked about this before.
Nate Silver. And he through very hard work and building his models, he really did it, of all things, with baseball, so they could make good decisions on who to buy. There's a little bit of this in the...
Is this the guy who wrote Moneyball?
Moneyball. But Moneyball is the same kind of thing.
Okay.
Billy Beane came along and said, I think that guys who get on base more than anybody else is more valuable than guys that hit home runs.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get more butts in the seat by a bunch of guys that get on base instead of hit home runs. But, you know, you get the point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very hard work. The signal, there's an awful lot of noise in this society, an enormous amount of noise. You get it every day. Yeah. I have not watched television in the last 3 years where I didn't see loads and loads of noise. A lot of
are you suggesting that even the New York Times has a lot of noise in it?
Well, I call the New York Times Pravda on the Hudson.
Pravda means Pravda was the Soviet newspaper of the day, and Pravda I think means truth in Russia.
It does. It means Pravda means truth.
Pravda was the one newspaper you got in Russia,
which is the big joke, on the front of it, in Russian, it's the model like the New York Times purports all the news that's fit to print. Pravda said, Stalin lived, Stalin lives, Stalin will always live. Let me make a point about the New York Times just because of what can happen. The New York Times under Sulzberger Jr., the publisher, which set the tone for the paper, took it way out to the left. Now, they will even deny today that they're left-wing, which is met with gales of laughter, even among left-wing people. Everybody knows it's the house organ of the left wing of the Democratic Party. Nobody doubts that. And it's fun, as I do every day, to read the Wall Street Journal editorials and the New York Times editorials on the same thing. And it couldn't be more opposite in terms of their perception of how the world works. But it would be a terrible thing to have the world run the way the New York Times thinks it should be run.
It'd also be a terrible thing if the New York Times was closed down, because they also offer a lot of good.
I would somehow manage to survive that.
I like the New York Times. Look, you should also read the
When I got married in 1965, remember, there were some 10 newspapers in New York.
Uh-huh.
We got 3 left.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, because they couldn't all make a living and we had other means of communication.
Right, right.
But the world would survive without the New York Times. I'll even go to the extreme of saying it could survive without the Wall Street Journal. But the Wall Street Journal's been growing. It's been competing and taking on the New York Times head on when it introduced under Rupert Murdoch this section they've got called Greater New York. And they've even begun to develop a sports section. So the New York Times, if it went away, we'd have a building to rent some space out.
What would you do without Paul Krugman? Paul Krugman, by the way, I read a lot of his columns, and you know, I mean, he's a Keynesian economist. We gotta wrap this up, but he does at least make a strong argument and uses a lot of evidence, and he cares. I'll give that to him. He cares.
Paul Krugman has appointed himself a superior mind, who therefore should be a powerful force in guiding how the society functions. There are a lot of people like that. I met Paul Krugman, had a lunch with him. He was personally very insulting. This goes back a number of years ago before he was Paul Krugman at MIT.
I hope
MIT.
You're listening to this, Paul, because I know you listen to the Brian Callen
at MIT. Very insulting, very arrogant, comes across that way on TV.
Yeah.
And those are among the most dangerous people around.
That's right.
See, there are a group of people. I'll finish with this.
Of Ellsworth too.
It is. Remember, we're talking about people not knowing how to argue, not how to get truth and so forth. Here is the key question you have to answer for yourself. Would you rather be governed by the Harvard faculty or by the first 2,000 people in the Boston telephone directory? And I think I know the answer to that. But a lot of people would differ.
Yeah, they would say, I want to be run by the philosopher kings, right, which is actually where where Plato and Socrates were probably got it wrong. They didn't solve the political problem. But the founding fathers would answer that question by saying the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book.
Right.
And God bless Boston. I hope you guys are pulling through. I went to high school very close to there.
And by the way, that first 2,000 would not get as far up as Obama.
You're not a fan of Obama's. Anything good to say about Obama?
Yeah, no, I think he's very well-meaning, and I think he comes out of a background which is totally devoid of anything to do with commerce, and the London Economist made that point.
Yeah.
So if you were asking me to run...
I was not impressed with his background. He didn't leave an academic legacy or a legislative
legacy.
Well,
we don't elect people on their backgrounds.
No, he was very good at just staying very neutral and speaking well. His track record is not very impressive, not as an academic.
All of that is true, and he is overstated as an academic. Yeah. That was never
very
what he really
so.
Did.
No,
that was never what he really did.
He was good
at
staying very neutral, and I think he's a very sensible guy. And that's what I'll say.
When you talk to him, it's no matter what you're saying to him, he's looking at you and he's nodding.
Yeah.
And you are forgiven for thinking that this man is agreeing with you. But that's what politicians do.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Mike Callen, Big Mike, thanks for doing the Brian Callen Show again. I know people enjoy this, and there's so much more to talk about. Hey, will you come back? I hate when people do that. I'll never be that guy. Hey, will you come back?
No, because you'll never invite me.
Ah, shit. All right. Hey, thanks, guys. We're out. And I'll see you in Florida, or I'll see you in Portland, or I'll see you in D.C. Come out. Later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.